Welcome to the Optimal Body Podcast. I'm Doc Jen.
And I'm Dr. Dom, and we are doctors of physical therapy, bringing you the body tips and physical therapy pearls of wisdom to help you begin to understand your body, relieve your pains and restrictions, and answer your questions.
Along with expert guests, our goal of the Optimal Body Podcast is really to help you discover what optimal means within your own body. Let's dive in.
So before we dive in on this episode with Rob, we just have to mention that Grateful for My Body 2022 is coming up November 1st, and it's like nothing we've ever done before. Yeah. And I am personally super excited for this because I tend to be somebody who carries a little more stress. And this whole month of November is going to be about down regulation, getting back into your body, feeling more by spending more time focusing on those things that we may have been neglecting.
And Dom is actually really going to do this challenge because we have a team challenge, like internally, that we're all doing this as well and kind of competing against each other. So that's our form of accountability to make sure that we get it. I mean, it's really only going to take you 10 to 15 minutes a day at max.
It's super easy.
It's really something that it's not going to pull away from your workouts. You can still do your workouts on your own. This is your way of getting back to your baseline, kind of resetting, relieving, releasing your body. Like, doesn't that sound good, especially around the holidays?
I think that this one's just, it's amazing. Like you just said, you can just add it into what you're already doing and you will feel something different. It's going to get you doing things that you're not used to doing with mobility, using different tools to help with down regulation, breath work, getting into the pelvic floor, which is something that I can always use a lot more work on myself. So you won't need to change anything else. Just add in this 10 to 15 minutes a day and you will feel something different in your body.
Oh, I'm just so incredibly excited. Now, the link is down in the show notes. Please click it. There's no discount code that you need, but know that early bird discount is disappearing after this Friday. So get in this week.
So this next interview was just a fantastic representation of some really good hydration, electrolytes, and overall nutrition information from Rob Wolf. Rob Wolf is a former research biochemist and 2 times New York Times and Wall Street Journal best-selling author of The Paleo Solution and Wired to Eat. Along with Diana Rogers, he co-authored the book Sacred Cow, which explains why well-raised meat is good for us and good for the planet. Rob has transformed the lives of hundreds of thousands of people around the world via his top-ranked iTunes podcast, books, and seminars. He also co-founded the first and fourth CrossFit affiliate games in the world, the Healthy Rebellion community platform, and is the co-founder of Drink Element Electrolytes. Just some fun tidbits about Rob. He also holds a brown belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, is a former California State powerlifting champion, and is 6-0 in his amateur kickboxing career. Wolf has provided seminars in nutrition and strength and conditioning to a number of entities, including NASA, Naval Special Warfare, the Canadian Light Infantry, and the United States Marine Corps. He has functioned as a review editor for the Journal of Nutrition and Metabolism and as a consultant for the Naval Special Warfare Resiliency Program. Rob lives in Montana with his wife Nikki and daughters Zoe and Sagan. Guys, listen up. This is an incredible, informative podcast on nutrition where Rob really talks into some points from angles you might not expect. So stay tuned. Rob, we're so excited to have you on to talk everything health, hydration, electrolytes, just really dive into some topics that we haven't touched on in significant depth on the podcast so far. So thanks for taking some time this morning.
Well, I know you folks were looking for somebody qualified and couldn't find anyone and got stuck with me. So I'm honored to fill in as best I can. So thank you.
Not sure getting stuck with you is such a horrible thing, but I know there's a lot to dive into. Now, first of all, I just want to break down what does electrolytes really actually mean? I know it gets thrown around a lot. We talk about it freely, but what does it really mean?
The electrolytes, you know, if we go to like a Guyton textbook of medical physiology, electrolytes are these charged ions that and ions are can be either positively or negatively charged if folks have had some chemistry or biology. And we usually tend to focus on the kind of metallic ions, sodium, potassium, magnesium, calcium, but there are also some negatively charged electrolytes, bicarbonate, phosphate, chloride. And those are super important too, but they tend to get kind of a backseat compared to the metal ions. And, you know, if we go to do some blood work, or he here's maybe even a little better example. If somebody shows up at the hospital and they're unconscious, like this person is just found on the street, and they're unconscious, they're still alive, they're breathing, but man, what's wrong with this person? Usually the emergency personnel will check blood sugar, because that could be a big deal as to whether or not somebody lost consciousness. They will check pH, because our pH has to be really, really tightly regulated. That's the acid-base balance of our blood. And man, it doesn't take much of a change there to make us either very sick or to kill us. And then electrolyte status, specifically sodium and potassium, are really the super important ones. And interestingly, again, other than pH, like electrolytes are arguably the most tightly regulated kind of physiological parameters that we have in our body. And the reason for that is it controls or is integral to literally everything that happens in our body. Fluid balance, whether or not we have fluid inside our cells versus outside our cells, and how much fluid volume we have in our circulatory system, like the way that which facilitates the way our heart pumps. And then everything from the contraction of our heart, the nerve impulses that, originate in our brain, all of, if you're wiggling your toe, all of that is largely driven by sodium potassium pumps, which are electrolytes. So what electrolytes are these charged molecules that help to run the electrochemical battery that is life, and they are really, really important to make things work properly.
Now, I just need to interrupt you really quickly, because if you're listening to this learning a ton, I mean, Rob is the go-to person to really talk about Element. So I don't need to add anything to that. I just want to let you know that when you use our link, so our link is linked up right into the show notes. It's drinkelement.com. Element is LMNT.com/optimal. You get a free sample pack with every single purchase. So even if you purchase Element before, please use our link, drinkelement.com/optimal. And you are going to be able to experience everything that he's talking about, all the incredible benefits from the inside of our body, so that we start to feel something different as we go through the day. And that's really what we want to provide our bodies, is just working optimally throughout the day, so we feel better, we feel more alert, and we can be more present for what we have to do on a day-to-day basis. So again, drinkelement.com/optimal. Go try it out.
I like that breakdown, and I was going to follow up by asking, what exactly electrolytes do in the body, but you covered that nicely right there. And so this is where I want to ask the next question, which is, isn't salt bad? We hear everywhere, oh, avoid sodium. And, a lot of what you talk about is how many people aren't getting enough sodium, or we need to make sure we have enough. So, like, where does that argument come from? Like, hey, salt's bad, avoid salt, avoid sodium. But on the other hand, you're telling us that a lot of people need more.
Yeah, it's a tough one, in that sodium is a factor in hypertension, and hypertension is a major risk factor for different aspects of cardiovascular disease, heart attack, stroke, thrombic stroke. The thing about it, though, is that, so if we back up a little bit, I think I mentioned a little bit that electrolytes and sodium specifically is super important in fluid balance, like how much fluid we have in our circulatory system, how much we have outside of cells versus inside of cells. And that's really tightly regulated based off of hormones and like insulin and aldosterone, and then also these electrolytes like sodium and potassium. And if a hypertensive individual, a person who has high blood pressure, sodium is absolutely a factor in that. What happens is that the body, under certain circumstances, mainly from insulin resistance, when we start to lose the ability to respond to insulin, which is this really critical hormone that helps us to regulate blood glucose levels and kind of energy status, when we become insulin resistant, all kinds of different things begin to happen. In some people, they gain body fat, especially around the midsection. Many people see their blood glucose levels increase. And for many, many people, they see their blood pressure increase. And it's because when insulin levels increase, when we are insulin resistant, when insulin is elevated, then another hormone called aldosterone, which is an adrenal hormone, is elevated, and it causes us to retain sodium. So it would seem like, man, if we just went on a low sodium diet, that would fix that problem. But the bugger is that that's not really true. There have been lots and lots of studies where hypertensive individuals, folks with elevated blood pressure, are put on low sodium diets, and it brings the blood pressure down a little bit, but really not that much. It's very unimpressive in the way that it modifies blood pressure. What is really impressive with modifying blood pressure is when we get people to eat a lower carb diet, if we get people to find a way of eating where they spontaneously reduce calorie intake such that they reverse their insulin resistance. And when insulin resistance is improved, when it's modified, then we tend to not retain too much sodium. And then we get to what we would call a normotensive state. And that situation is then when we typically need a little bit more sodium. And that how much really depends on, you know, whether you live in a hot, humid environment versus a cooler environment, whether you have a really physically active job or hobby versus a more, you know, sedentary lifestyle. But the kind of demonization of sodium is not, it's not a silly thing. Like it would be trite to say that was a silly thing to do, because sodium is absolutely associated with blood pressure. But the thing is that we kind of went after it from the wrong direction. It's a bystander in that process, not the primary driver of hypertension and that increased cardiovascular disease risk.
Yeah, I think that's really important to kind of point out there and bring the awareness of like, okay, well, what is actually root cause issue in all of this? And I think that's what we don't always look at in society, or we haven't been told from the medical society sometimes, is we're told what the symptoms are. Oh, it's you're hypertensive, you're too high in sodium, you need to avoid salt. And we look at like that overlying thing rather than getting to that root cause, which I think is so incredibly important to bring it back to. And what does someone like, so if someone says, well, hypertension runs in my family, high blood pressure runs in my family, I'm going to avoid salt. You know, what do you kind of say to people who have this mentality? Well, this runs in my family, so I just want to get ahead of it now and not have too much sodium in my diet.
You know, I think that looking at family history is a really important thing. But again, the important thing there is to make sure that you're dealing with a root cause and not chasing a symptom. And this is a great example. When we don't consume enough sodium to support us day to day, like if we put people on a very low or even like a zero sodium diet for extended periods of time, what's interesting about that is that their blood levels of sodium don't really change that much. And that is because we store sodium throughout the body, especially the bones. And when we are low in sodium from a dietary perspective, we will mine sodium out of the bones. And ironically, what we pull out of the bones also is calcium, which may then exacerbate the calcification of our arteries. It's kind of controversial whether or not that's a direct factor there, but it is absolutely crystal clear that there are fantastic studies showing this really tight correlation between low sodium intake and increased osteoporosis events. And so the thing again that's critical for people to understand is that sodium is a bystander in this story. It's not the cause of hypertension. And if we really drill down and look at what is driving hypertension, high blood pressure, it is insulin resistance for the vast majority of people. And that what's interesting about insulin resistance is usually that's associated with overweight, but not always. Like I'm one of these people that I'm 5'9", 165 pounds. If I really went off the rails eating, I would never make it to 300 pounds because I would die before then because I do become very hypertensive and develop all these other health problems. And this is kind of a diversion, but there's this idea of the personal fat threshold, which Some people, interestingly, are able to gain significant amounts of body fat while remaining relatively metabolically healthy. And then at some point, they will lose metabolic health and usually become insulin resistant. And other people can be rather lean, pretty slender, but can be metabolically unhealthy. They can be insulin resistant and having all kinds of problems under the hood, so to speak. So the, you know, looking at family history is really important, but if you really want to address hypertension, you have to look at calorie intake, and really kind of total carbohydrate load is one of the easiest ways to address that. This is the amazing power of kind of reduced carbohydrate diets, and it doesn't have to be a ketogenic diet. Like even just shifting more to what most folks would call a Mediterranean diet from like a standard American diet, you get a lower glycemic load. You get a total reduction in the amount and type of carbohydrate that you typically consume. This will bring down insulin levels. Usually the person will lose some weight associated with that also. And then we're in a pretty good spot. Usually the blood pressure normalizes. And for the first 5-7 days of that diet, when people started a new eating plan, usually they will pee a ton. And what's happening there is that their body is shedding the excess water and the excess sodium and getting them back down to a normotensive state. So again, like it's fantastic if people are looking at family history and taking some proactive steps to fix things, but it is really unfortunate that still for the vast majority of medicine and medical recommendations, they will tell people who either have hypertension or have a family history of hypertension, hey, eat a low sodium diet. Mm-hmm. And here's the deal. If you are hypertensive, consuming extra sodium isn't going to help you necessarily, but reducing sodium dramatically isn't really going to help you all that much either. We're still not addressing that root cause. And it links back to the fact that we will just give ourselves likely some osteoporosis by mining the sodium out of our bones. So we really have to do some diet and lifestyle changes, improving sleep, all the sleep hygiene, because sleep disturbance can be a major vector in worsening insulin resistance and that metabolic syndrome, which is kind of the primary driver of high blood pressure and hypertension.
Mm. No, I love that. And I think we can continue to nail at the point that in our body, in our physiology, we can't really isolate these tiny variables like sodium. We have to understand that it operates as a part of a whole, and there generally has to be a little more multi-directional plan to address some of these things like hypertension versus just eat less sodium. And while we're on this topic of diet, I know that you like to talk a lot about diet. You've mentioned some like the keto or Mediterranean.
I actually hate it at this point, but
okay, let me rephrase that. You're an expert,
but it's a painful spot. But keep going. I'm sorry.
Well, I'll rephrase that and say you're very good at talking about diet and how it can impact people's health. And it's just such a popularized topic, and probably playing into the point that the reason that you're starting to hate talking about it, because everyone wants to throw out this, oh, keto diet, or you should eat paleo, or go low carb, or whatever it is. So how does somebody understand like what the best approach is on how to find the diet for them?
This sounds really trite, but the best approach is whatever somebody is going to stick with over the long haul, and that what works for them. Like I've eaten a pretty low carb diet, pretty much a ketogenic diet for 23 years. But I have some really complex gut and autoimmune issues. Like when I was very sick 23 years ago, I had ulcerative colitis so bad that I was facing a bowel resection. I had what was clearly, when you look at my hand, some rheumatoid arthritis brewing. My mom had rheumatoid arthritis. She ended up dying from some complications from that. So for me, I have some gut autoimmune and blood sugar problems. And man, I've done everything. I've done gut resets. I've done prebiotic fiber, every, probiotic on the market. And I just don't do that well with a lot of carbs. I can eat a little bit of fruit here and there, a little bit of tubers, a little bit of carrot and a little bit of potatoes, mainly post-workout. But I do a lot better fat-fueled. And like I in my 20s, I had hypertension. As a now 50, almost 51-year-old guy. I have great blood pressure now and awesome blood lipids. And so I have gravitated toward this low carb way of eating because I was going to die if I didn't. Mm-hmm. And I watched both of my parents develop different flavors of metabolic syndrome. Like my father was type 2 diabetic. He drank a lot. He also smoked, but he had his big toe amputated, then all of his toes, then part of his foot, then all of his foot, and then a below the knee amputation ultimately. And I had to do diabetic wound care on my dad because I was still, you know, near home at that time, and it sucked. And I just said to myself, I am never going to put my kids through this. So for me, I found a way of eating that you know, I enjoy it relatively. I would love to have more latitude than what I have, but I'm very grateful that I was able to put my autoimmune conditions into remission. My wife's mother died from autoimmune complications now close to 20 years ago, and she died at 50. She died at the same age I am now from rheumatoid arthritis complications. Wow. And they never learned about the stuff that I know, so they never had the chance to even try this stuff. So depending how severe your health situation is and how motivated you are to live, then you may be, you know, greater or lesser extent, you know, willing to do some pretty extreme stuff. There's some folks like Jordan Peterson, Michaela Peterson, who eat only ribeyes and lamb and stuff like that. And that's the only thing they've figured out to eat to be able to keep their gut and autoimmune conditions in a good place. There are other people that can have a remarkable amount of latitude with their diet. My wife is an example of that. She is much more carb tolerant than I am. She doesn't have the GI issues that I have. And thank God that she doesn't. I don't know if our relationship would work if we had two people that were equally as broken as I am, you know? Yeah. But it really just boils down to what is your goal and what's your motivation on this stuff? And usually aesthetics are a high motivator for people, but only for short term, like that weight loss goal and stuff like that. For some people, it ends up being a big deal and is enough to help them to navigate diet and lifestyle changes. But usually it needs to be something else. It's like, I want to live to see my grandkids. I want to live to do this or do that. Or I just don't want to be a burden on my family. I want to have a long, healthy life and then a short, you know, decline and done. And so, you know, the right diet approach really depends on the individual. And again, depending on the severity or the complexity of health concerns, that will force one's hand as to how much more constrained things need to be to make things work. And just as an aside, I do Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. I've got a brown belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu now, and it's very grip intensive. And for about 3 years, I was noticing that my hands were kind of swollen and my joints hurt. And it's kind of a common thing in Jiu-Jitsu that your hands get beat up. But I did an experiment where I cut out dairy entirely, and in particular whey protein, which I would use occasionally as either like a low carb bar or like a shake here and there. And lo and behold, the 98% of the joint inflammation that I was having in my hands was caused from an autoimmune response to dairy. Mm. And now it absolutely sucks that I can't use, you know, whey protein, even to be able to grab like a Quest bar or something like that. Like yeah. We're traveling and I have this kind of easy grab and go deal. A big tub of Greek yogurt used to be one of my favorite, like on the road, you know, meals that I would grab because it tastes great. And I just get this full fat Greek yogurt and you know, it works well for my blood sugar, but it is really a bad fit for my autoimmune issues. And so this is, as of about a year ago, I learned that dairy just really doesn't work for me on this kind of autoimmune side. And I saw my mom and I've heard about my wife's mother decline due to rheumatoid arthritis issues. And I'm like, okay, full stop, done. I'm not even going to play with this. Like I'm not going down that road. And my hands hurt barely ever. Wow. You know, I mean, they effectively don't hurt now, especially compared to what they had been like for about 4 years.
Well, and I think that's so fascinating. Thank you for sharing all of that. First of all, too, I mean, I think everyone does, you know, we're surrounded by seeing health struggles a lot of the time from family members, from what we go through ourselves. And a lot of times it's still like, let's look, which is great, right? Let's look to medicine to see what is going to help us. But at the same time with that, we have to say, okay, well, what's the underlying cause? And being able to adjust what we're putting in our own system to see what kind of effect that might have on what we're feeling, what we're experiencing, the symptoms we're having. So just the fact and the ability to say, okay, I'm going to now cut out dairy when you already have, you know, a pretty restrictive diet is something that some people will say, oh my gosh, I can't even picture that, or I can't imagine, you know, food is something that is so culturally based and socially based in our world. And I think that's it's a hard thing to wrap your brain around, especially if we've been told messages like, you know, well, meat has a lot of sodium, so you want to avoid it. And you don't want to, you know, you talked about getting the ribeyes in and stuff. And some people, they hear that and they freak out. So how is consuming a higher meat-based diet actually going to be good for someone in the long run?
One big element of that is a higher protein diet is more satiating. And I wrote a book. I know that like the, you know, kind of climate change side of the meat story is really complex and people are, you know, very interested or concerned about it. And that book is called Sacred Cow. I'll also have a film with the same title that really digs into that. But funny enough, even though that book mainly unpacks the health, environmental, and ethical considerations of a meat-inclusive food system, it's honestly probably my best nutrition book because it looks at nutrient density. It basically looks at what are the foods that one could eat that provides the most nutrition for the least calories. Any dietitian that you talk to, you would say, well, you would want a nutrient-dense diet, right? And they're like, yes. But what's funny about that is then when you start looking at actual nutrient density data, most of the foods that dietitians recommend are not actually all that nutrient dense. And meat and animal products, shellfish, stuff like that are the most nutrient dense foods that we can consume. And what's interesting is when folks are under eating protein, and this is this thing called the protein leverage hypothesis. It seems to apply to all organisms, seemingly, that at least the ones that eat other things. If the organism eats adequate protein, then the organism tends to then stop eating. And if the organism does not obtain adequate protein from its environment, it will continue to eat until it does. And so what we find, and this is kind of interesting, like in the low carb world, there are some folks in the ketogenic space that are really freaked out about eating too much protein because of some things like insulin-like growth factor and mTOR. mTOR is a gene that's really important in immune function, and it overactivation of mTOR seems to be linked to increased cancer rates and whatnot. But you have some folks in the ketogenic diet space that eat very low protein diets on par with what we would see from generally like a vegan diet. And what we find is that these people have a tendency to overeat. They have a tendency to gain body fat because they aren't satiated. So the big pitch that I would make around consuming some good quality animal products is that you will tend to not overeat. And I don't care if you go low carb or higher carb from there. And a lot of that will be dependent on just how you run. Some people do better on higher carbs. Some people do better on lower carbs. There was a fantastic paper that came out of the Weizmann Institute in Israel several years ago that they put continuous blood glucose monitors on about 2,000 people, and they started feeding these folks different individual foods and different combinations of foods. And what was fascinating is that they found that any given person could have a shockingly different blood glucose response compared to another person, or even compared to just eating one type of food versus another. So my wife and I did this experiment where she ate 50 grams of carbohydrate from white rice. I ate 50 grams of carbohydrate from white rice. Her blood sugar topped off at 2 hours at about 115, which is fantastic. Mm-hmm. And mine got up into nearly diabetic ranges. It was almost 200 and I felt awful. Mm-hmm. And this kind of, you know, validated what we had seen empirically for years, which was, I don't do all that well with a lot of carbs, and she can kind of, what's funny about my wife is she could go low carb, she could go high carb, like she's just super metabolically flexible and can kind of do whatever she wants. But what we notice is that the commonality there is eating enough protein, and enough is usually about a gram of protein per pound of lean body mass, at the low end, all the way up to about a gram of protein per pound of body weight. And if you have weight to lose, then we would say a gram of protein per pound of ideal body weight. That's a pretty good bracketing. And if folks eat that, if they make sure, you know, they get three meals a day, and let's say you need 150 grams of protein per day to kind of meet that goal, then you have three meals, or like three meals and a snack, and you have about, you know, 30 to 40 grams of protein at each meal or snack, then when you fit that in, and then you round things out with hopefully minimally processed, ideally whole foods, doesn't really matter if it's high carb or low carb, unless you have some other extenuating health issues like I do. Usually people can be pretty metabolically flexible, you know, from there. But that focus on dense protein, which is really difficult to get other than from animal products, really sets folks up for success. And I guess my greasy used car salesman pitch around that is, try that approach for 30 days, see how you look, feel, and perform, and then try something else for 30 days. Like try some super low protein, you know, vegan approach, and see how you look, feel, and perform, and just compare them. And what I've found generally is that when people are eating adequate protein, ideally from animal source foods, it's really comparatively easy for them to find a calorie intake that works for them, and that they're not overeating all the time.
Mm-hmm.
No, I think that's really important to touch on. You know, a lot of these benefits that you can get is like the nutrient density, the satiation you can experience from eating some high quality animal products. But I noticed that you tend to say high quality, and you've touched on, you know, the importance of the farming conundrum that we are kind of in. And you mentioned your book, The Sacred Cow, I believe you said, where you dive into this in much more consideration. So I just kind of want to ask, what would your pitch be to people on why it's important to eat high quality or ethically raised animal sources of protein, or just eating organically, regeneratively farmed products in general? And I know that there's health considerations, environmental and ethical considerations that go along with that.
Man, that is a relatively short question, and it takes a lot of time to unpack it. And there's a lot of nuance
seconds
in that. Yeah. Yeah. So here's the deal. And I end up making people angry on both sides of this story. Like if they're more of a fan of like the grass fed meat only, then I tend to make those people angry. The more like conventional meat growers, I will anger them in some ways. And here's the deal with this from my perspective, but I think in the book we do a really good job of scientifically supporting this position. So I wouldn't call this an opinion piece. I think that we have a really strong facts to back this up. But here's the thing with it. The meat that you buy at like a Walmart or a Costco is usually part of what we call the CAFO system, like the confined area feedlot, you know, system. Even the meat in that system spends 70-75% of its life on grass. And although not all of that, the meat in that CAFO system is raised in what we would consider a regenerative fashion, a lot of it is. Just a lot of these regenerative ranchers don't have other options other than putting their meat into the CAFO system. So that's a thing to consider there. Also, when we look at the way that ruminants like cows, sheep, but cows in particular, they are so incredibly good at taking low quality food stuff and nutrient upcycling it into really high quality nutrients. So a lot of what is used in finishing animals are crop residues. Like if a wheat or a corn field has been harvested, they will let cows go through that area and eat all the leftovers. When we make ethanol, basically booze, you know, like the spent mash from beer and wine and distilled spirits are fed to these animals. None of that really fits into the like pastured organic story, if you're going to be a purist about it. But at the same time, we would be stupid. I mean, literally stupid to not take advantage of that. That is such an amazing way of dealing with this process. So there's a lot of things that we could do to improve our food system. And ironically, and this gets out in the weeds a little bit, but processing and slaughter is actually one of the most difficult parts of this thing because it's monopolized. The big meat producers have basically, via processes with the FDA and the U.S. Department of Agriculture, have made it damn near impossible for small-time operators to have easy access to slaughter and processing. And again, this gets out in the weeds, and I don't know how much y'all want to get into this, but a lot of the things that people don't like about current animal husbandry and the way that the current system works is an artifact of the legal machinations that have occurred to make it very difficult for small-time operators to go and get their animals processed. Like, people will ship their animals 1,200, 1,500 miles to be slaughtered and processed because there's nothing locally accessible to them, because we've had these really ridiculous legal constraints put on this whole system. And again, like, we really dig into this in the book and the film, so it's tough. Sometimes I feel like saying less on some of these topics is better than more, because it's a lot to unpack. But, you know, the ethical considerations of animals being raised in a more regenerative scenario are really obvious and are really profound. The environmental improvements are very significant. But at the same time, one of the things that has been super frustrating for me is that folks who are fairly wealthy, fairly well off, will make some statements like, well, you should either eat grass-fed meat only or nothing. And it's like, okay, that's great for you, but what about an inner city family that's trying to raise their kids and they're living right at the margin? And what they're being told is that they should feed their kids like basically a vegan or a vegetarian diet. And I think that that's actually going to be a disastrous process. And we detail why in the book, like, the kids have massive failure to thrive because of just wanton nutrient deficiencies because of the lack of animal products. So you're taking kids that are already disadvantaged, and then you're making all of society, all of media, all of government tell them a lie that is that they will be better off from a health and environmental perspective eating no animal products, when this CAFO system meat is going to be one of the most nutrient dense things that they could ever eat in their diet. And it could make a huge difference. Like there's somewhere between a 10 and a 20 point IQ difference between a kid that is raised with adequate animal products and not. And it's kind of jaw dropping, but this stuff is super well documented. So again, like, it's a really complex topic. Like, I'm one of the biggest fans of regenerative ag that you could ever find. But at the same time, I find that people become elitist about this, and they really just don't, they literally don't have a clue how our food system works, and the reality that although a herd of cows may not be technically pasture finished because they're being used to deal with crop residues and like ethanol mash and stuff like that, that's still an amazing way to deal with that stuff. And it still is taking low grade food that was either going to be landfilled or composted, or it could be fed to animals like sheep or cattle and nutrient upcycled and then turned into food for humans.
Yeah. I love that you kind of highlight and break that down and bring it back to, well, what is reality? And what is reality for the majority of people, not just, again, the people who can afford it. People can go into way more detail in your book and in the film, and I think they should if they're interested in really understanding and learning this topic on a greater level. You know, I think just touching on that is, it already helps, even in my mind, to bring more awareness to really the issue and what's happening. And now, say someone is like, okay, I'm doing my best in my diet. I'm cleaning out anything that's really processed, and I'm finding what's working for my body. Now, I'm interested in adding these electrolytes in, but at what rate? How do I know, am I just going hard and I'm doing one every day? Am I like, how do you start to know how many electrolytes you need to add in and how that kind of works within your life?
That's a good question, because sometimes I'll have two or three packets a day.
Yeah. And you know, the funny thing is the dosing is maybe the most difficult question to answer.
Yeah.
Because are you a small female? Are you like, are you a 5'2" female or are you a 6'4" male? And so size of individual is going to be different. And then also sex differences are non-trivial. Women are much more efficient sweaters. Like when women sweat, for every, say, like pound of sweat that they release, they disperse more heat energy out of the body than men do, because men tend to sweat in rivulets, whereas women have much more dense sweat gland, you know, per square inch. And this is likely because the developing fetus really is not super tolerant to significant extremes in high temperature. So women are just more efficient at sweating. Men tend to sweat more in drops and rivulets, which is less efficient, but also tends to rob them of more sodium. The environment that you are in can double or triple electrolyte needs. We spent 2 years living in Texas, and my baseline electrolyte needs were double what they were in Texas compared to what they are in Montana.
Wow.
Like it was just stunning. And we weren't even in the super, we were in the hill country, which is hot in the summer and still reasonably warm in the milder months, but it was at least double what my standard needs are. And then I do Brazilian jiu-jitsu 3-4 times a week. Mm-hmm. And I've weighed my gi before and after going to jiu-jitsu, mm-hmm. and this is kind of disgusting, but my gi will be 4 to 6 pounds heavier,
oh my gosh,
with sweat after a 2-hour session than before. And you can expect that each pound of water is extracted about 1,000 milligrams of sodium out of my body. So in that session, I lost about 6 grams of sodium. So how much do we need? It's super dependent on your individual circumstances. Mm-hmm. What we do from a recommendation standpoint is we've looked at some epidemiological data where it looks like, in general, the low ebb of morbidity and mortality, death and disease for most people, seems to be at about 5 grams of sodium intake per day, which is about double what the American Medical Association, American Heart Association recommends. Like they recommend under 2 grams of sodium per day, but the data is pretty clear that the low ebb of morbidity and mortality is about 5 grams per day. And then from there, what we start thinking about is, are you active? Are you in a hot, humid environment? And like we've seen some work with, say, like wildland firefighters, where they're out in the heat and they're wearing protective gear. And by when I'm saying out in the heat, it might be 110 degrees. And they're basically wearing like the warmest set of, you know, pants and jacket you could imagine to protect them from the fire. And we'll find that those folks need 15, 18 grams of sodium per day to just survive, to maintain, you know, basic activity level. Now, that's a really extreme example, but I would say anywhere between 5 and 8 grams of sodium per day for most people. And again, the larger you are, the more hot and humid it is. I know like sauna is really popular right now. People will go in dry saunas and whatnot. Even wet sauna is maybe even worse from a sweat perspective. But you could lose a couple of pounds of water and several grams of sodium as a consequence of that. So we need to think about replacing all that. And usually what we do is, again, recommend that people are getting at least 5 grams of sodium per day from all dietary sources. So minimally processed whole food diet. We recommend things like pickles and olives and sardines and salami and these higher salt foods that also tend to have lots of potassium with them, because we need significant amounts of both sodium and potassium. But when we sweat, the main electrolyte that we use by orders of magnitude is sodium. And then from there, we just tell folks to pay attention to how they feel. Like if you're feeling lethargic, foggy headed, like if you just ate, but all of a sudden you're feeling kind of hungry, like that could be a sign of some sodium deficiency. And so we'll mm-hmm. then recommend adding in some additional sodium and electrolytes to the degree that helps those symptoms to resolve. And when people are on point with sodium specifically, what we find is that they don't really get that afternoon slump in energy. They have really solid energy levels throughout the day, consistent cognition. Their sleep improves. Like if people are tracking their sleep via an Aura or Whoop or something like that and tracking heart rate variability, they find that their heart rate variability score dramatically increases with the addition of adequate sodium. So again, it's hard to tell folks exactly how much they're going to need because there's a lot of variables that go into it. But again, for most people, at least making sure that you're getting that 5 grams per day is a pretty good spot. Again, if you are hypertensive, you don't necessarily need or want to be at that 5 gram per day, but also a low sodium diet isn't fixing your problem. So mm-hmm. like we still need to get back in and modify your diet and exercise and lifestyle and everything so you're not insulin resistant. And then ironically, when you are metabolically healthier, you will need more sodium then.
I love that answer because it kind of like helped even point out a lot of things that I think intuitively, you know, is the reason that I'll have quite a few more packets of Element and Jen might have one a day.
Or half of one a day.
I mean, she is in the 5'2 category. I am in the 6'3 category. I'm originally from Minnesota, now living in Southern California. I sweat mm-hmm. when I think hard. So thank you for pointing out yet another reason that my wife is so much more efficient than I am in how she disperses her heat through her sweat. And I take, you know, 3 to 5 saunas a week. Yeah. And every time I work out, I'm losing just leagues of water. So that makes a lot more sense.
Yeah. But I also want to ask too, just quickly, you know, I'm in a phase where I am currently 6.5 months pregnant and I still use Element. So I just want to know, you know, what does that look like in pregnancy? Can people, I mean, I just said I take it, but can people safely take, you know, electrolytes during pregnancy and even breastfeeding?
Yeah. So let me tackle the breastfeeding part first. Yeah. So, and this is anecdotal first, and then I'll back it up with some science. We were maybe 6 months into having launched as a business, and then we started getting tagged on social media, and it was from these exclusive pumping communities. And my wife, she had some problems latching with our first child, and so she ended up exclusively breast pumping for over a year. And my goodness, the stress involved with that, you know, which is itself really problematic for breast milk production because cortisol antagonizes breast milk production. You know, any type of stress tends to antagonize that situation. But what was crazy is that these breastfeeding moms, exclusive breast pumping moms, would post these pictures of these little bottles where they were like, I got this much in this bottle yesterday, and it's like a tiny little amount. And then I used this Element, and then the next day I had like 4 full bottles. Mm. And you're like, holy smokes. And when you think about this stuff, breast milk production is not just driven on how much fluid you consume. Like if a mom overconsumes water, it can actually reduce breast milk production because she's becoming hyponatremic, low sodium, and the body will shut off breast milk production because she could die because of the low sodium. So what you need to be able to facilitate breast milk production is adequate electrolytes, specifically sodium. And even when you look at the way that the body, this gets really down into like the molecular biology of the way that this stuff happens. But when, say, like the casein and the lactate that is produced in the mom's breast tissue is expressed through glands to be released, you know, to the baby when it's breastfeeding, that is all facilitated by sodium co-transport mechanisms. Sodium is swapped in exchange for moving these charged like casein and lactate particles through the breast tissue and to be released to the to the baby. And also that is all driven by fluid volume, which is also driven by the amount of sodium and electrolytes that we consume. And just consuming water doesn't fix that. This is one of the just like damnable, you know, frustrating things is we tell people, in particular breastfeeding moms, you know, drink more water. That doesn't necessarily fix the problem. It can actually worsen the problem, because if we take the mom and get her into a low sodium environment, a hyponatremic state, it will curtail breast milk production. And I guess I ended up weaving some of the like physiology behind that, but there are some great studies that show supplementing with adequate sodium and electrolytes in the breastfeeding environment generally dramatically increases breast milk production. And I mean, my wife did everything. It was like, you know, half of a beer and like all these like witch's brew things and everything. It kind of worked, but she really laments that this electrolyte thing wasn't on our radar at that time. And this has been one of the most rabid groups of people that have supported Element and just like electrolytes in general is this group of moms who they're kind of like, I did a lot of work with Naval Special Warfare, and these Navy SEALs are really good at finding things that improve performance. Like they're just always looking for something. And my goodness, these moms are so tuned in to what their body performs well with. And they figured out that if they get adequate electrolytes, like, you know, just kind of magic happens. So I would say for the vast majority of women and, you know, the situation in which they're breastfeeding, adequate electrolyte is actually a non-negotiable feature of adequate breast milk production. Mm-hmm. Clearly, you can have, again, like hypertensive individuals, preeclampsia, you know, the gestational diabetes. Those can all be considerations. But in those scenarios, I would really recommend my friend Lily Nichols, who is an expert on helping women navigate that gestational diabetes scenario. And again, what it ends up boiling down to is we need to do some diet and lifestyle changes so the mom isn't insulin resistant. And then these you know, gestational diabetic features are largely mitigated when you get things buttoned up the way that Lily recommends.
Mm. Yeah, Lily's fantastic. We had her on a podcast not too long ago too.
Yeah, she's great.
Great.
Yeah. And we have both her books. I love her.
Yeah. Fantastic. Rob, this has all been so incredible. And I feel like we just scratched the surface and didn't even get to dive into other topics like, you know, more on the sleep optimization, muscle cramping, so much more that we could have dove into. But I know that you have a lot of that living somewhere on blogs or in your own podcast. And, you know, just to mention, co-founder, like we say at the beginning in your bio, you're the co-founder of Drink Element, which is the electrolyte company that we've kind of been talking about. Jen and I have been faithfully drinking daily Element for about the past 6 months and absolutely love it, and have been experiencing some of the benefits that we've been mentioning on this podcast. And if anybody's interested in that, we'll have a link down in the show notes where you can get some ordered up, and you get a free sample pack every time you order to try out all the cool and unique flavors, as well as experience some of the benefits that we've been chatting about here today. So where else can people go to continue to learn more about you on some of the topics that we've touched on today?
Yeah. It's been a ton of fun chatting with y'all. RobWolf.com is my main website. I do a lot of writing for Element, and so drinkelement.com, we have a blog that you can find over there. And like, we talk about fasting, low carb diets, high carb diets, we talk clearly a lot about electrolytes, but we talk about a lot of other health concerns as well, and usually end up linking it back to kind of, well, why is this germane to electrolytes? But those are kind of the main places you can find me hanging out. I have some social media handles, but I really don't go on social media anymore. I've just found it to be a toxic cesspool of craziness. And so I post some stuff on there occasionally and never look at the comments again. And so if you want to talk with me, actually, I do have a Substack, robwolf.substack.com. And what I've found crazy is that just the process of signing up with your email, it's a free Substack, but just the process of putting an email in, keep it, everybody's really civil and enjoyable. And so if you have a question for me, that's probably a good place to drop a question, is over at my Substack.
Great. Amazing. Well, thank you so, so much, Rob. Again, you're just a wealth of knowledge, and there's so much more we could have dove into. But you guys, get his books, continue to learn from him, read the blogs, such good information. So thank you so much for your time, Rob.
Thank you.
An incredible interview. I feel like we could have talked to him for like hours. My goodness, he is so knowledgeable. I hope you learned a ton from that and you share it out with those who might need this kind of information. I think this is the information we get to get out to people to help understand a little bit more about our bodies and how we can help and fuel our bodies. And if you want to check out Element, don't forget, it is the link in our show notes. It is drinkelement.com/optimal. And that is where you go to really help support our podcast and support what we're doing and the information we're bringing. And also you get a free sample package with a purchase of Element. So I hope that you check it out. I hope that you feel the differences in your body and start off, no matter where you are within your journey, starting to listen to your body and get a little bit deeper.